Love and respect and information from the Progressive Radio Network and Gary Noll. If you've never watched Gary Noll's documentaries on the health and environmental effects of military operations and nutrition and everything, please do. It's extremely important, incredible information. Well, we're going to take a step back in history today, and we're sitting here. We got Ray and myself. We got another Chris who's sitting here as an OIF veteran, went to Iraq. But our primary guest today, and we're going to talk about 9-1-1. What happened on that day? How does it affect the families? And we've got our gentleman today. His name is Bob. His son was killed in the World Trade Center on that day. Bob, welcome to Warrior Connection, sir.
Thank you.
Well, could you tell us a little about your son, sir, and what happened on that horrible day, and what has happened since, if as possible, sir?
That's a big question.
Well, I know it's a real one, but people need to understand what really transpired on that day.
Yeah, well, that's been a big time problem. But anyway, Bobby was 26. He was my oldest son, my first son, and he went to Princeton. And right out of Princeton, he went to New York City, and he always wanted to be a writer. So, but he had to get a job to live in New York City. So he wasn't going to He wouldn't make too much money being a writer. So he started in public relations, and it was actually just about 3 weeks before 9/11. One of his main clients was Merrill Lynch. He was Burson Marcello. He was working with Merrill Lynch, writing for them, for advertising, whatever. But they liked him so much, they hired him. And they hired him as a vice president of media relations. And plus, they were going to send him to graduate school. But I don't know how long he was going to work there, because, again, he wanted to be a writer. But on that day, he lived up in NIR 66 between 1st and 2nd. He would come down the subway every day, so he'd be on the you'd be on the east side of the World Trade Center. We get off the subway. Now, we were both at work when 9/11 happened, so we weren't too concerned immediately, because he worked at Merrill Lynch, which was on West Street, right across the street from the North Tower. And but we didn't hear from him, so then we all went home that day. So we went up to New York it happened on the 11th. That was a Tuesday, and we went up on Wednesday to try to find him. And we did find him, actually, that day. We found him he was at the morgue, and we took him home and buried him Monday, the following Monday. It always gets tough. But anyway, so we did, it was so traumatizing. You didn't think of anything at that time. And I joined, the peace movement, things of that sort, that kept me busy, because, when we decided to go to war, I just didn't believe it. And that, we should be going to war because of this. And Bobby was a very progressive person, and he wrote for the progressive newspaper at Princeton. And not that I was a progressive person or anything like that, but, I was influenced by his politics. At one time I was a Republican, another time a Democrat. But anyway, so that kept me busy, and I joined a group called 9/11 Family for Peaceful Tomorrows, and I did go around the world talking against war, that this wasn't a reason for war. I really didn't believe it. I still considered it a crime, but there was nothing. And I actually went to the peace demonstrations in New York City and Washington D.C. As a group, we led the march in New York City. And it was very fulfilling. It makes you feel good that you're trying to do something. So it sort of alleviated the pain that I still had. And, of course, my wife, and she was involved in the peace movement also. Then I went to all the 9/11 commission hearings. And towards the end of it, I just got so angry. And, in fact, it was exactly the time that Condoleezza Rice testified before the commission. I just got so pissed off, and I had an interview with Canadian Broadcasting afterwards, and I just lost my cool, and I said, this is such absolute bullshit, and I just can't stand it anymore. So then, I had all sorts of interviews after that, and I decided, well, the heck with this piece. I just had such rage, such anger. I said, I have to just spend my time looking into 9/11. And to move along quickly on this. We took Bobby home. We buried him. I never looked at the body. I never wanted to find out exactly what happened. And the fact that we had a body, you know, that was a monumental thing on 9/11. You know, in fact, I don't know anyone that had a body. And there were some recovered, but we didn't know what the circumstances were. We were told by Merrill Lynch he was heading up to the 106th floor for the seminar. And so everyone sort of assumed that, you know, he was on or heading to the 106th floor, but the fact that he was one of the first bodies found, it was sort of perplexing there what exactly did happen. So finally, about 2006, I got the guts to go to the I think it was on 2nd Street where the morgue was, and I actually sat down with the doctor who examined him, and he gave me everything I needed, the charts and all, and exactly how he died. And from looking at that, and I've come to this summation because of the injuries to his body, that he was walking into the towers. And I honestly believe he died before the planes actually hit the buildings, because I've talked to so many people that were in the lobby, outside the lobby, whatever, and huge bombs went off in the lobby. I mean, you know, I have quotes where it said it looked like a tornado hit it. And if you would look into the entire affair, the FBI, everyone was saying, well, the fuel was coming down the elevators. And I don't want to bore everyone talking about the elevators, but the elevators were a three-tier system. Well, the damage done in the lobby was just mind-boggling. You know, all the windows were blown out. Now, this lobby was 208 feet by 206 feet. What the square footage of that is, I don't know. But all the windows are blown out. And some of the injuries in there, and my son's injuries, they were injuries of, he had post-mortem burns, but his whole front of his body was just like someone was, you know, three or four people were standing there waiting for him to come in and shot him with shotguns. That was the nature of his injuries. So from that, you know, and of course in the 9/11 community, there's some that, you know, there's been a lot of very dysfunctional things happening. And of course, so many people believe this story. And you know, myself, I just never, since that time, I have never believed this story. But for the sake of making it easier for me, I now go around saying, well, I can honestly prove that Muslims had nothing to do with Bobby's death, because I can't prove that he died seconds before the plane hit, but he died from an explosion. He didn't have burns on him when he died. It was a huge detonation that came, and with the injuries to his chest, glass all over it, and, you know, again, I won't go into all the injuries because it's kind of gruesome. But he died instantly. He died walking into the lobby. There's no question in my mind about that. And with that, instead of trying to prove to everyone that the United States was involved in it, which I will say they were, but I'd rather say that Muslims didn't kill him. He was murdered. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He was murdered. And then if you read through the 9/11 Commission report, I mean, it was just a waste of time. I even heard Bob Curry down at lunch one time, you know, during the commission hearings, that, you know, this is nothing but an exposition. You know, they were just bringing out facts. They had the whole story, you know, put in front of everybody in the beginning. Philip Zelikow, he wrote the book, 9/11 book. And so, they weren't there to investigate anything. They were just there to set the story straight and then move on. And it really pisses me off about that. So I'd rather say, well, look at these people. I mean, I feel guilty bitching and moaning about Bobby dying that way, you know, when you have had, since then, millions of people have died. And so I'd rather go out and speak, and I have, you know, I've been around the world speaking about this, you know, South America, Japan, that first of all, the war is idiotic. The wars that we've been in have been idiotic. But I'd rather say that my son was murdered, not by Muslims, but someone within, and I have no problem saying the United States committed this act of horror at the Trade Center. And then I have no problem walking or doing interviews like this and explaining this fact that these people, the Muslims, had nothing to do with my son's death. He was murdered, and I've had no you know, I just haven't been, you know, no one wants to listen. And so that's why I will do these interviews, and I will speak up. And again, I've done interviews around the world, and I have no problem saying this, but it just seems like the people in the United States, they just can't believe that an evil thing like that could happen. And and being a history teacher, and it's very important to me to tell people this, that you must understand your history to believe that something like this could possibly happen. And, you know, I've talked to many people, you know, and really to make it easy on people, like going back to the Iran-Contra, I think people from the Iran-Contra were part of this because, you know, that became the Enterprise, and they were certainly working with these, with Osama bin Laden, setting up terrorist cells around the world in Europe, Yugoslavia, things of this sort. And it was so easy to do. And it's changed the world, dramatically. And it's going to, you know, as I think Dick Cheney said once, he said, this is, you know, we'll be at war with these terrorists for the next 100 years. And it might be the truth. So people have to realize that this is what the state, this system does. They do things like this. And it's, when you think about it, it's only 3,000 people. You know, when we go from World War II, I mean, just talking about Iran with Mossadegh, with hundreds of thousands of people that we set up after overthrow of Mossadegh and setting up the Tsar, you know, the SAVAK, the secret police in Iran, hundreds of thousands of people died. And, of course, we can just go on and on and on. Central and South America, Africa. And to me, the system is doing this. You know, it's the system of so-called free enterprise, unbridled capitalism that we'll go to, or John Perkins, I spoke with him a couple years ago, talking about you send the jackals in if they don't agree with us, if they don't change their system, then we overthrow it with our military. So all these things, and I think that's the most important thing. To understand 9/11, you have to understand our history from 1900 on. But people, I don't know what it is, they sort of want to look at the United States and say, well, you know, it's like the father figure. They can't believe that evil can come from the United States. And that's where my toughest task is. And, you know, if I talk to people, they'll start rolling their eyes. They just couldn't or won't believe that they would kill citizens of the United States. But then I'll tell them there's other citizens around from around the world who are also in the towers. So basically, you know, so it's for, you know, for my son's sake, I feel bad for my family. I feel bad for my, you know, I don't have that many friends now that really want to talk to me because they're afraid I'm going to talk about 9/11. But I have to do it because, again, he was murdered, and I've gotten no relief from that at all. And that's why I do things that I do now. I hope I didn't bore you too much there.
It's an incredible story. I think you and I both have a very good friend, Willie Rodriguez, who has told this story over and over again. And he got to work, around the same time your son was walking in the building when the first explosions went off. And the police and the fire have absolutely reported the explosions in the lobby down the sub-basement 3 and 4. And we know from the photographs of the rescue work, and that's been published by Life, and the stuff that Willie and the guys, Police and Fire, published, there were no fires in the stairwells or the elevators or anything. I mean, everything was intact, no smoke, no fire and everything. And yet the explosions that happened in the basement, where they were, as Willie said, they were already loading the casualties on with the, you know, when the aircraft hit there. And yet all of this stuff doesn't show up in the 911 Commission report. And I lost so many really good friends in the police and fire department on the emergency services unit that day. And another police lieutenant, first name Bill, who was right there with him, and he probably was involved with your son at some point or another or right along. I mean, he lived, but he's real sick today.
Yeah, oh. You know, every it seems like every other week, you know, someone else is dying from, you know, the rescue workers. And, you know, I got to know quite a few of the rescue workers, but, you know, I've sort of dropped off. And, well, a lot of people have really had so many problems. And I haven't found the person that found Bobby. And I think I thought I knew who it was, but this girl was in such bad shape. I hated bothering her, but, you know, again, Bobby was rescued immediately. You know, he was, I think, one of the first 10 taken away. And again, this is what I've surmised from, you know, years later, after I finally had the guts to go up to New York City and talk to the doctor to examine him, and then got all the information. You know, they gave me, you know, the autopsy report. And you know, but what these people have gone through is just, you know, the sicknesses. And I say that I know that I was in contact with the girl that found them, but she was in such bad shape. I don't even know if she's alive now. But, you know, again, you say what these people went through. But it's just that, no one, you know, even people who believe or sort of believe the 9/11 story, but when you get to the, you know, and that's why, you know, I hate getting involved with arguments with 9/11 family members. But the thing is, this is how Bobby died. And you can't debate that issue. He died. There's no question about it. We took him home. We buried him. And he died from explosions, you know. And so where do these explosions come from? Well, Al-Qaeda didn't create these explosions in the basement and in the lobby. So your next step is someone had to put those explosions there. But it seems like no one wants to go there. You know, and that's where my big problem is. You know, you know, certainly if they could prove that Al-Qaeda, quote, or the Muslims put, you know, blew up the buildings, that'd be fine, but they'll still go back to, well, the fires, you know. And no matter how hard you try, if someone doesn't want to know, then they just drop the conversation right there. And, you know, you have to put the effort in to find this information out. You know, and for some reason, you know, just because I say it, they're going to say, well, you know, that's not what we've been fed. You know, and I you know, people say, well, who did
right
it?
Away and we got on me? The phone that morning because we wanted to make sure they had the proper equipment. We didn't know what was transpiring other than it was horror. And we got through the emergency services unit in New York City because we trained all these guys trying to make sure they had all the proper equipment. And then as the morning progressed and as the time went by, it's just like, as you said, first off, here's the horror, and this is what everybody is told. And then as you start putting the pieces together, the picture becomes extraordinarily horrible. But one of the things that got, and this is right out of the 911 commission report, and this is where I understood what was coming on, quote, Franks told us that he was pushing independently to do more robust planning on military response in Iraq during the summer before 9/11. The request President Bush denied, arguing the time was not right. CENTCOM all began dusting off plans for the full invasion of Iraq during this period, Franks said.
Jeez.
So we knew we had the invasion plans in place. I was involved in writing them, as our team was. And then all this stuff happened, and now they scared everybody off, and it seemed like within hours, without any rational thought or anything, we're at war. And then it left all your families and everybody, your son and you and your wife and your whole family and all the police and fire guys that are just kind of like, what the heck happened?
What'd you say?
In limbo.
Yeah, you're right. Well, that's this group, September 11, Founding for Peaceful Tomorrows. Obviously, you know, they're all family members. And we would go, and they're still speaking around the world. I'm supposed to go up tomorrow and be with them, but I don't know if I can make it. But anyway, that was our feelings, that the war is insane. Our loved ones died, but the thing is, that's not justification for the war. This is before, you know, before we even had a 9/11 commission report or even hearings, and we're ready to go to war. So but even now, 9/11 family members, no one speaks up anymore. They just, I don't know, I just don't understand it. You know, I try not to get angry, but the thing is, if so many 9/11 family members, if you stick with just that little blurb you had talking about all these things, you know, Willie Rod, you know, listen to Willie, you know, he was there, he saw the refrigeration unit blown up, you saw the pass station, there was damage down there, and of course the whole lobby looked like a tornado going through it. Yet we accept the 9/11 commission report said, well, the flames coming down the elevator shaft blew out the lobby, plus the FBI floor and the 23rd floor, plus the fire blew out part of the pay station and all the levels below. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable how they got away with that. But that's just, you know, what the 9/11 Commission report gave one line to the whole subject.
When you, when you talk to the 9/11 Commission report, did they take any input from the families or discuss anything, or it was just kind of like all make-believe and decide what they're going to do without talking to you?
You know what, and they're the courageous family members. I sat there and listened to everything. I finally just lost it once. But, you know, some people would start, you know, screaming at the panel. Said, what about this? What about that? The fire, the explosions, and they were escorted out. So all the family members, you know, we show up to the commission hearings and listen to it and sort of accepted it. I finally just, you know, lost it after Condoleezza Rice, but, you know, there wasn't like we're demanding this information on that. And, of course, all the Jersey girls, they had a long list, you know, 300-some questions, and the questions they wanted answered wouldn't be answered, you know, so they're, and you just couldn't get to the commissioners, you know, it was open sessions, but the thing is, it wasn't open to us. But I didn't know from anything at that time. You know, I was sort of listening to it, but then as you saw the commission hearings going on, you know, they were talking about, again, Condoleezza Rice, and, you had the warnings and all that. But each commissioner, they got frustrated also. They only had 5 minutes to grill these people. And of course, they're not under oath. So Condoleezza Rice, she was just bullshit for 5 minutes. Then that commissioner is done, and she got to another question. And she just, you know, they would get pissed off at her. You know, because she just wouldn't answer. She said, well, didn't you get the warning about, you know, this and that? You know, so it really was frustrating. You know, but then as a family member, I feel great going around. I felt great, you know, going to other countries and talking about, you know, I was down in Bogota, Colombia, and Japan, and, you know, talking about peace. We don't need wars. But then I said, you know, this isn't getting anywhere. You know, I was in two marches. Each was 250,000 people. I got arrested at the White House. Well, what did it do? Nothing. So I figure, well, at least I can speak my piece. I said, you know, I'd rather go around the world telling people Muslims had nothing to do with my son's murder, and this has to be solved. And I have no problem saying the United States was a big part of the orchestration. I have no problem blaming the United States. Let's go back to Iran-Contra. These people that were working with the terrorists, you know, and this is the way it is. This is the way the world works. I don't know if I've gotten anywhere. I know a lot of people have listened to me, and it's been around the world, but we just have to understand that, you know, this whole system stinks.
Is when you bring up the truth, or I brought up the discussions with the police and the fire, or like you have, the average person gets so angry that they don't want to hear it, and as if they shut off the conversation. Oh. And then the military personnel, I mean, we're sitting here, Chris, you're sitting right here. I mean, you enlisted and went into this, went to war because of 9-1-1, correct?
That's correct. I remember I went to the first tour, matter of fact, and just listened to you. I remember I had the first week. They gave me only 1 week to pack my bags and go and ship out. They didn't even give me no notification whatsoever. I remember I get actually a FedEx, and boom. 1 week, I got to get going. No time to do my bills or get ready to go. 1 week. No time to get going. I was like my first shipment to get going on the first four. And it was quick. And it was not time to actually say goodbye to my family or anything. And it was almost ridiculous. But I signed the contract, and I had to do my duty. And it happened. So,
Ray, what have you found in all your work down to Camp Lejeune and working with the military? I mean, when they have any idea of
say that one more time,
what really
Dr.
was or what's happened, or don't they want to look at it?
No, they really don't. They're focused on the future, and they're forgetting the past, and they're saying it's past. Let's just go on. And, you know, they're trying to deal. I have programs that I've been working there with post-traumatic stress and moral injury. And when I listen to Bob, I can hear so much trauma in his life. And then the repercussions of that. It's just phenomenal the way it works with the human spirit, you know, and we've talked about it many times before about how the humiliation. I was writing a little while ago, and I'm working on a new book, and it's on a veteran's journey through the dark side of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was writing about the humiliation and the degradation of death and how it's so destructive to the survivors. Because when you see somebody you care about has been mutilated, it puts a picture in your brain that will never go away again, and you feel like you have to vindicate that somehow. And I can understand Bob, his frustration with that and his pain. You can hear it in his voice. And, Bob, I'm so sorry about your son, and I know your family is still grieving for that. And you will probably never get over it, but what you try to do is move on, and what you're doing is trying to at least get a little vindication and trying to help other people to realize, look, there's things working around us. We need to stop this stuff. We need to find them and, you know, make people stand, in court or wherever they have to go, because there's a bigger thing working there. And I tend to believe you, Bob. You found some evidence of some things, and people need to know about it. I appreciate you coming out with that.
Thank you.
You know, when we think about that, your son's one of the first to die, and you were lucky to recover him. But then we think about all the others and all the military personnel that have gone on. And then I think about all these non-combatants and these civilians and the people in these other nations that have now died or been wounded and they're sick. And then I couple it together with all the, and we talked about it ad nauseum, the incredible environmental contamination from all these military operations. I mean, not just overseas, but as you know and as reported and what we work with every day, all the police and the fire and the rescue and those that were in that World Trade Center or the Pentagon that survived are all sick today.
I mean, and dying.
The consequences are horrific.
Well, Bob, a lot of people were talking about how the terrorists, they're talking about the terrorists, and they were so shocked that the building came down, and most people never thought those buildings would have come down, and it was just circumstances and all. Do you think people really intended to knock those buildings down or just to create a diversion?
Well, And again, in a court of law, you really can't get anywhere with it. But I think a lot of scenarios were going on. I think the buildings were attacked. And, you know, there's a lot of information about this. You know, well, let's just quickly talk about the 23rd floor of the FBI offices up there. And the 22nd, 23rd floor were, practically destroyed. You know, quite a few people now. And this was before the North Tower, I'm talking about the North Tower. This is before the towers came down. So you have a lot of eyewitnesses. I even think Willie was up there. And they were doing an investigation on gold laundering and gold fixing and laundering of money also throughout the United States, in the United States. And yet those floors were destroyed, absolutely destroyed. Now you wonder, why would this happen? Well, of course, there's been a lot of information out because they were looking for, they're investigating these crimes that have been committed. And so that's what, you know, if you go back to history, of course, you go to the Nazi gold. I know there were reparations, you know, for the Jewish people that lost their gold. But then you go back to the stories about the Philippines and the Japanese gold that were taken over by Patton or McCarthy. And, of course, put in the banks throughout the world. And there's a lot of stories out there. It's a long story. The Gold Warriors by the Sterling, Peggy Sterling, and I forget who else. It's a wonderful book to read. But anyway, and again, I don't want to spend all the time on that, but a lot of stuff was happening. So there is stories out that I really do think George Orr Bush, they had these bonds that they took out in 1990, 10-year bonds, and they were due on September 11th or on September 12th, the day after the 12th. So they had to bring these bonds, and it was $240 billion. And this is money that they had taken from the Japanese, or the gold, the diamonds, and so forth and so on, and distributed throughout the banks around the United States. And So these bonds, so it would free this, these $240 billion in securities that they had up in Cantor Fitzgerald. So again, these are stories that have gone on, and so the the spots that were hit, Eurobrokers, and of course, why was Building 6? Well, I forget, it was in Building, I mean, I think Eurobrokers were in Building 6. So all these things were damaged by the planes. Well, I think other groups, I don't know who, you know, well, Deutsche Bank. You know, there's stories about Deutsche Bank because they were getting screwed so badly that, you know, I think this is where another group might have came in somehow, some way, put the bombs in there. And I just think maybe the United States wasn't ready for that. You know, you'll hear the Russian mafia and the Mossad, you know, so that's speculation and there's no way to prove it. But I think one faction, I think Bush wanted to cover all this up with the planes hitting in particular Cantor Fitzgerald. And of course they, you know, you had a big hole in Building 6. No one ever talks about Building 6. Then all the investigations that were taking place in Building 7 also, that had to come down. So the banks, you know, you sort of have to look at the banks, and that's part of that is the system that created the scenario where we have to bring these buildings down. So it might have been a plan to hit these buildings with planes, so to destroy a lot of this stuff, but then others figure, well, this isn't going to be good enough. We're going to have to bring these buildings down to just totally destroy everything. But that's something that takes a lot of research. And, of course, you know, it's like the CIA. You can never prove beyond a reasonable doubt they're involved in anything. You know, they get away with all these things in South and Central America and anywhere. So, I mean, I would put the CIA right at the forefront that they're the ones that could possibly orchestrate something like this, a worldwide thing. And then, you know, then you have the rogues that, you know, like the Iran-Contra people, the Secords, the Shackleys, and Richard Armitage, which, you know, he spoke at the 9/11 Commission hearings. I would put their names right at the top because they could have set up these patsies easily, you know, in the United States and make it look like they're getting training for flying planes in the building and so forth and so on. So, you know, it's a real long, drawn-out thing. And, quote, the beauty of it is, it's tough to pinpoint any one person to say this person, this group, or so forth and so on did it. But I really do think the investigations that were taking place about this money laundering and the gold, I mean, they're talking trillions of dollars out there that we don't know about, that these banks like Bank of America, you know, and their dealings with Deutsche Bank. And, you know, it's just it's so deep and it's so horrific as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, to go into that subject, nobody even talks about that at all. So, I think also at that time in 1999, I think the world was changing. You know, a lot of people around the world just didn't like this system that we have. And I'm not talking it's necessarily capitalism. It's the capitalism that we see. You know, it's the one percenters. And, you know, the one percenters have taken over. So there's a lot to it. And that's why, you know, I really think you have to really work hard to look at how something like that could happen. But I think if you do look hard enough and you see what the CIA does, you see what the other intelligence agencies are, it's all about money. It's all about power. And so this is a minor thing as far as they're concerned, 3,000 people. But look what's happening around the world. You had Iraq. You have all these countries that were developing. They were evolving into, people in Iraq, you know, the women could walk around with the regular garb on. You had free education. You had, you know, free health care. And I'm not saying anything great about them, but the thing is they were evolving. Now they're all back in the Stone Age. Well, that's how we want it because, hey, that's the way it's going to be in this world, you know. To explain to anyone, it really takes a lot of effort. That's why I'll just go back to Bobby and say, well, I can guarantee you a Muslim never killed. It was not part of his murder. I'd rather people look at it that way and say, well, geez, well, then why are we having these wars? And I said, well, they're wrong. That's why I think it's going to take a revolution. We got to say this is idiotic. We've killed millions upon millions of people based on a lie. Now, if everybody could get that straight, but say people just don't want to believe that we could be that bad. And it's, again, they, you know, Congress, they're idiots. They don't, you know, presidents don't have any power. So it's, you know, what is the system? Then you define a system, and that's really difficult to define. You know, but to me, it's all big money, you know. So, but the thing is, we blame, we're at the, all these wars because of this, and that's the horror of this whole thing. You know, just innocent Americans are dying, innocent, you know, people around the world will continue to die. So,
it's been said many times, but it's always been a sad conclusion. Some people don't even want to understand it, that war is really good for economies. And sometimes nations feel pressed, and they will go to war just to stimulate their economy, get rid of some people maybe, and the world goes on their way. After World War II, the world got straightened out, and economies began to boom again.
Yep.
And it's a sad conclusion, but you know, you take a thunderstorm, it does clean out the trees, it does all these things, and it makes a yard better and all these things. And I think when man gets hold of that thing, the people in higher places decide, look, the best thing we can do is create something here or be part of something here or go over and help somebody out and the economy be doing good. That's why that's one of the reasons I believe they didn't want to end Vietnam very soon, because it was so good for the economy. As far as jobs and building, you know, military products and all these things. And so I guess it's just a way that countries do, and we're the poor suckers that get tied up in this stuff because we didn't want it anyway.
Well, we haven't even talked about drugs, too. I mean, you know, when you talk about Vietnam and Afghanistan, you know, people will speculate also. You know, we didn't want to get out of Afghanistan. Afghanistan, they were progressing. I mean, the drug trade's a monumental thing in this world. And in our economy also.
When we look at Afghanistan, I mean, 9-1-1 was used to invade Afghanistan, but the directive was from February 12th of 1998 to go over and overthrow the Taliban because of the Unocal pipeline deal.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's clearly done. And so the invasion plans were put in place. And as we know, again, the same thing for invasion Iraq, it was totally in place. Everything was done. And now the consequences are horrific because you and your families, everybody that lost your loved ones in that horrible day, and as you said, your son died before the aircraft hit with the explosions going off that we know that did happen. The police and the fire and Willie Rodriguez is all totally confirmed. But then in the end, with all of us that are surviving and Chris and everybody around here, they're dealing with this in-depth moral injury now. This in-depth PTSD because they believed in something that was happening outwardly, but yet deep in the mind they realized, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. 2 + 2 doesn't add up.
No. One of the things I feel pressed about getting this book finished on moral injury, and it's called Life After Trauma, A Pathway to Purpose, is that not only the military, I think about 70% of our military say they have post-traumatic stress. I think nations like Israel has like 1%, but we've got like 70%. And then our civilian world, because of so much things have been going on, immorality within homes and things for so long, is that we have a civilization in America that is, it's no imagine how many people that are dealing with post-trauma and moral injury from being violated in so many ways. And so it's a national crisis.
It sure is. Well, you know, when you're talking about war,
what do the other families feel, or what do they think, or how is that all transformed over the days from that horrible day to the present? How do the families, the other families you know, how do they respond or function or act, or what's happened with them?
Well, it upsets me, and it's very frustrating. But I can just, you know who the Jersey Girls are, right? You know the Jersey Girls?
No, I don't.
Well, they were instrumental. There was five women, not girls, but they call them the Jersey Girls. They're the ones who were instrumental in bringing the 9/11 Commission. I mean, they were great. They really put a lot of pressure on everyone to get the commission, because they had the original commission, and that was nothing. So they really pressed the president, and they were damn Washington constantly pressing the congressman, and they made up all the questions for the 9/11 commission. And of course, it became very frustrating. But to get to your point is, if you have a family, it's just impossible to keep doing this. You know, because, you know, if you're at work, you're going to get fired. I know people have gotten fired. You know, it's the dysfunction it creates in your life is just mind-boggling. I'm a grandfather. You know, I get a chance to see my grandkids. So that really helps me. It's very difficult on my wife. I mean, she's with me 100%, but I just can't make it my entire life. So for anyone to jump into this as a family member who lost someone, it's just like going into Peaceful Tomorrows, it's great because you're working for peace. They were the best times of my life. I felt good about myself. I'm talking to people in Colombia, in South America. You know, I met generals from Argentina that were part of the death squads down. You know, but the thing is, I was in Japan with people who Hibakusha who were survived the bombings and things of that sort. But I felt good, and I talked to. I would actually go into schools, colleges, and talk about anti. You know, that I don't want war. You know, just because my son was killed, I don't want war because innocent civilians died in wars. I said, that's absurd. But the thing is, I really felt good about myself. So that's, you have to, and this is what the problem with a family member, you want to feel good about yourself. Well, if you have a family, you just can't be doing this stuff. You can't be going out and saying what I'm doing because then you're going to get bad coverage. Then people just ostracize you. They don't want to hear from you. So if you're a job, you're going to lose your job. I know people have lost jobs when they decided to jump into this stuff. Well, you can't talk about this at your place of work or employment. So as far as family members are concerned, it's just out of such frustration. And I know a lot of family members were doing what I'm doing. But so for that reason, that you just can't exist in the workplace. And then if you have children, you can't be putting this in the children's head because you have to let them find it out themselves. But you can't be telling them this and that. So it really destroys your life. You know, you lose friendship, you lose your job, and you lose your mind. It's, I have more of an advantage that I don't have to worry about. You know, I certainly, when I'm with my grandkids, I don't talk about 9/11, you know, so it's a break for me. But as far as, you know, it frustrates me because, well, one person that joined Peaceful Tomorrows, you know, I won't mention her name, but she just said, I just got so sick of hating, you know, and that's, so she had to take something where, geez, I'm dealing with people that, you know, are trying to do good things. And that's why they stay there. And, you know, they don't want me around them. I'm going to functions with people, but they don't want to talk about 9/11. So they're all family members, but they don't want to talk about it. So it's a big, big-time problem. And that's why you're not going to hear 9/11 family members speaking. Just doesn't happen.
Bob, I'm a chaplain also, but when I was coming up, they used to tell me that when you began to, if God ever gives you a purpose and a charge to do something, when you begin to do those things, it's almost like the devil will latch hold of you, and you have to drag him to do what you want to do. But when the devil realizes you're not going to stop, he'll start driving you. So you have to learn two things. You have to learn when to push and when to back off. And that helps you to stay in that same mindset. And I know how you can overcome, because I fought that too in my life, I feel like there's a, when I'm writing this book, it's like it's going to put it into production of reaching more people with what I'm doing that I truly believe is working. And there's a drive behind that. But I also have to realize you have to be able to back off sometimes just to get sane yourself. You got a family, you got children, you got all these things around you that you have to maintain. They're looking to you. And if you go down, they may go down. So, you know, I would encourage you, learn how to push and learn how to back off a little bit, and you'll get a good end of that.
Oh, I mean, that was beautifully put. It really was. And I have learned to do that. I mean,
that's
just
great. I'm still learning.
Yeah, well, I say, every week I go over, you know, I take the kids to school, the grandkids, my son's a track coach, so I get, you know, so I really, you know, it's, when the one woman said, I'm sick of hating, and yeah. I don't use the word hate. I just want answers. But, I mean, the way you put it is great. And I do work hard on backing off. I really have to, because it would just drive you into the loony farm.
I think the horrible consequences
from all this stuff
is... But
that is the reason family members don't do it. And because, you know, I sort of have that advantage because I don't have... You know, a 12-year-old here, you know, 12-year-old, I can't be doing that in front of him all the time because he'd go to school and start talking about it. Then he'd get in trouble. So, I do have that advantage.
Yeah, another way of saying that too, Bob, is that I know in my own personal life I'm doing a lot of things, and it seems as though God has opened up so many doors to me. But he's also helped me understand it's not enough to hate evil. You got to love good. You got to love your family. You got to love God. You got to love things that are fighting for.
It's well, that's the beauty of family, you know. Yeah, being around the grandkids, it's like being in heaven, you know. It's that's such a big help. And my son doesn't want to hear about anything either. I know he supports me, but you know, when you have kids eight to the, down to one, you know, you can't be worried about all this stuff. You know what I mean? So
that's true.
That really is a big help. But no, you know, when you're talking about war. And, you know, it's about, you know, it's Smedley Butler's book. I keep bringing it out and reading it. You know, War is a Racket. You know, he wrote it in the 30s. You know, it's probably the best book ever. It's a real thin book, but I just wanted to throw that in real fast.
You know, the consequences of all this just are not going to end, because the individual out there that's gone to war and came back and they're wounded or injured or sick or their families are all messed up, and yet the horror continues on. And when we look at the police and the fire and the military personnel, I mean, the police and the fire, they're right. They were in the New York Police and Fire Department. They've had to fight for medical care and the retirement and everything else. And then we had the 442nd New York Police and, I mean, New York National Guard unit that were made up of police and fire from the New York Police and Fire Department. They went over to Iraq. And they got sick over there, so they got zapped, double zapped from the time they went in the World Trade Center to do the rescues and lived. And then they got deployed and came back. And then the horrible thing is, like the other ones, they got abandoned too. And this abandonment, I mean, all the way through, what is the truth and what is happening and why do we do it? And it's almost as if you try to bring it up that you get ostracized, because nobody wants to look at the horror. That's why the Vietnam vet hasn't come back, Ray. I mean, he's still struggling trying to fight and justify what happened, and now you've got Desert Storm, and now you've got OAF, OEF, and they're trying to justify and fight it in their mind, and yet deep down they're going, what is this about?
Yeah, well, you know, when we were young, we talked about this before, Doug, of how it seems a nation many times will dress something bad up as patriotism. And a lot of people want to be part of that, and they want to be able to, you know, my particular part was I wanted to do this when I was young because I wanted to be able to look back and feel like I've accomplished something, or at least I did something patriotic. But I didn't realize the scars that are left from those places. And, you know, my book was called The Never-Ending War, The Unseen Scars of Post-Traumatic Stress. And I've been writing, kind of going through, getting excerpts out of my first book. And, you know, for the second one, and it's like it is a never-ending war. And once you send men and women into combat, especially when they're young, they are never the same again. And so you're really not euthanizing, but you are really causing a lot of problems for the next generation coming up. And we can see that. Well, look at the bodies out there on the, you know, landscape of Vietnam veterans who never was able to recoup and do anything with their lives. And it's really a travesty when you really look at it.
What's
I used to tell my students in martial arts,
I mean,
nobody ever wins a battle. Just one side loses more than the other.
What's a possibility in the future? I mean, when I look back at what's happened and what was involved, and Bob, we talked to you and Willie and talked to the other police and guys and knowing them. What's in the future? Are we going to see something like this again? Are we going to see something like this to get political justification where all hell breaks loose again?
I think it's definitely going to happen, personally.
I do, too.
You know, they just, although, you know, again, you look at Trump and people, you know, I don't want to talk about Trump, but, like, you know, I think he needs something like this desperately right now. God knows what could happen. I mean, young Bush, he needed it back in 2000 when he was elected. I mean, God, his popularity wasn't too great. 9/11 certainly pumped him up as an unbelievably popular president. So that's the nature of false flags. That's to me, and probably our educational system is to blame. People don't learn this. I mean, what is a false flag attack? Well, the Reichstag fire. You know, people always talk about that with Hitler. That, you know, in Vietnam, of course, you know, you talk about these wars.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying but, you know, of course, we're never going to see it in newspapers. We're never going to see it on TV anymore. There's no such thing. They learned that in Vietnam, that they had to shut the newspapers, the TVs off, because they were showing some of the atrocities were taking place. And they learned their lesson. Well, we're not going to see those three little kids that were just killed the other day. We're never going to hear about that in Yemen or whatever. It's a little bit of news, but then people don't see the horror of it. And it's our media. You know, if someone asked me, who do you blame for 9/11, I would say, well, let's start with the media, because they immediately ran with the whole story. Well, there's a lot of people that know that they were getting false information, but they reported it. These people were just as guilty as anyone. You know, if they saw someone murdered, it's their job to tell the other people who they think murdered them, because they were part of it. So, and that's why, you know, I talk about history, but people just don't want to go through that. You know, like when you're talking about everything, you know, war is a racket. It goes back to Smedley Butler. You know, divide and conquer, that goes back to Rome. You know, they've been doing this forever and ever and ever. And people continue making big-time money. And that's, to me, it's like all the people that voted for Trump, your middle-class white man, you know, they're frustrated. Well, they're the ones that are going to have to come out and finally say, geez, we really made a poor decision. They have to come out. The blacks have to come out. All the immigrants, everyone has to come out. It has to be a revolutionary type of thing. You know, get back to Martin Luther King. Where, like, you know, get 3 million people in Washington. This system stinks. They're constantly trying to divide us, and they do a great job doing it. And it's easy to do. And as long as you have the firepower behind you, we'll continue to do it forever. As long as you people still make big-time money. That's
Bob,
where all
were
the
you
power
in the military,
lies.
Or did you go to Vietnam, or did you were in college and luck out, or what happened on that side, sir?
I took my physical. You know, I played four sports all through high school and college. You know, I'm a great athlete and all that, but I had asthma. I remember they sent a nurse to the house. They said, "Well, we didn't want you." So that was 1968.
Well, you didn't miss much, I'll tell you, Bob.
No,
Doug and I can tell you that. But, you know, you talk about today and could it happen again. And I worked for the police department for a while. And, you know, you had to think like the criminal in order to be able to cut him off or to find him. And I look at the situation right now of where the immigration problems are, where Donald Trump stopped immigration from coming in. And when they turned it around and reversed that, they flooded in. And, you know, that could be a terrible situation, or it could be a – could have been planned out that way. I don't know.
I definitely think it's planned that way. I really do. It's, you know, again, it's all about that divide, you know, divide and rule. The divide and rule was Rome, but then it became divide and conquer. You know, the same thing in the Middle East, you know. It's just, I think everything's a, you know, mirage. Just keep people separated. If you don't have
well, I heard
it,
on
it,
the
it,
news,
we'll never
and
have
heard
change.
It too, and, but Donald Trump was saying, he was saying, well, that Ninth Circuit Court will be blamed for anything that happens now. It's like, oh, that's bad. That's bad.
Yeah, you're right.
So it's a blame game, and it's so it
and
could
it works
be a bad
all,
deal.
It works all the time.
Yeah.
What's next? Where do we go from here? What are we going to do next? I mean, I know I'm not expecting an answer or anything. I'm just posing the question. We've got just a few minutes left here. What's the possibility?
Well, I think the only solution, I really do think the only solution, I mean, I'm really sincere about this. I don't know who possibly could lead it, but it is a revolution. And somehow, some way, you know, like a Martin Luther King type of thing, a nonviolent revolution, that you just have to have, everyone has to unify and go to the streets. And that's worldwide. Back in 1999, that was happening. That really was happening. You know, I think that could be part of 9/11 too, because I think the people of the world realize, hey, we all got to get together, and we can change the world. You know, let's bring Russia into it, let's bring China into it. Let's make this a world where everybody can live. But some people, they don't want that. Again, they just, you know, the war is the essence of power. It's the essence of money. So I don't know.
Well, Bob, thank you very much, sir. Chris, thank you. Ray, thank you very much. God bless you. And we're horrible for the loss, but thank you for telling the story and leading us in a conversation that we need to have. God bless you, Bob.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me,
Bob.
Okay? All right, take care.
Thank you, Chris.